It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a look at the difficulties inmates face getting prescription medications for mental health issues when they leave prison.
First, an event this week aims to help Wisconsin veterans and their families deal with issues they face when they get back to civilian life. The Wisconsin Warrior Summit takes place this Wednesday and Thursday in Madison. We've got a link to event information on the Central Time Facebook page.
We have two speakers from the event with us now. Dr. John Munt is a clinical psychologist who works extensively with veterans. John, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
And here in the studio, we've got Doug Bradley. He's a Vietnam veteran, former Army journalist, and author of Daros Vietnam, Dispatches for the Air-Conditioned Jungle. Doug, thanks for joining us, too.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, let's start with you, John. In your talk, you're going to talk about what civilians may not know and what veterans may not say when talking about their deployment experience. What kind of things do veterans avoid talking about?
Well, Rob, my experience is that veterans very frequently may be most comfortable talking to other veterans simply because they don't have to say a lot about some of the experiences that they may have had overseas. Families may press for details, may be ready to hear details, but they may not really be prepared for the kind of stories and events that the vets returning may have experienced in the war zone. So very often I'm talking about the kind of things that would occur if you're on an extended deployment to a place like Iraq or Afghanistan. It could be traumatic or at least just could be difficult for civilians to really understand.
So what's your advice for veterans who maybe are facing questions from family members, friends, coworkers back in civilian life, trying to reach a comfort zone with what they are willing to talk about and how to avoid, how to say no, I don't want to talk about that?
Many of my clients have success with just talking to the family members that they trust the most, perhaps the person who's most likely to be able to hear how they're feeling and then disseminate that to other interested people. And usually just telling them, when I'm ready to talk about this, I will. I appreciate your support. I appreciate knowing that you want to hear about this. Give me a little bit of time to get my own head around these things.
And Doug, let's bring in you in now. You've got some advice. You're on a panel talking about the use of creativity for veterans to express these issues. What kind of things are you talking about?
Rob, there's a number of things we'll be talking about. I liked what John said about trust. I also was interested in his point about veterans relating to other veterans. And we need to find some of those ways that the community can be engaged and with the veteran and vice versa. One of the things we've found in a writing group that I work with here in Madison and other outreach I've done with other vets, both from the Vietnam War and the current wars, is that, not everybody is going to adjust or readjust in the same way. Not everybody is going to be able to heal in the same way. So if you have opportunities, perhaps through music, perhaps through writing, perhaps through art, whatever it's going to take for the veteran to be able to perhaps come to better grips with that experience and maybe find a way to begin to express that, we think is a way for that veteran, for him or her, to get home.
And you brought us a journal, actually, with people doing exactly this. This is writing in particular, but memoirs, some fiction. Talk about this. This is the Deadly Writers Patrol I'm looking at here.
I know. It's an interesting name. It's one of those curious things that it's been there, and we stick with it. And what's been really intriguing about that, Rob, is the fact that it's not every form works for everybody. For me, it was short stories sort of based on Ernest Hemingway's In Our Time that were loosely based on the experience I had and then fictionalized. As you mentioned, some other guys have done memoirs. There's a lot of poetry and spoken word, some extraordinary spoken word and poetry coming from Afghanistan and Iraq vets. So regardless of the form almost, if writing is the conduit, get it down, work with it, share it if you can, and continue to process that experience.
And John, in working with clients over the years, is this something you've seen as successful for some people, whether it's writing, art, poetry?
Absolutely. In addition to the modalities that Doug just mentioned, I also see an awful lot of simply stunning visual art coming out of the veterans I've worked with from all eras of military service. And even a couple who have written plays, performed them, or directed them, So I like the way Doug put it. There's just what's important is that it gets out, and we don't want to ever assume that everybody's had the same experience or needs to find the same way to express it.
So I want to get into some of the issues veterans are dealing with. We hear a lot, of course, about PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And John, are veterans likely to be looking for the symptoms and then seeking treatment if they need it?
Well, I think that also varies greatly from veteran to veteran. A word about PTSD first. I think it's crucial that people understand that post-traumatic stress disorder is just one possible response to traumatic events. It happens to be a particularly severe and a particularly persisting response, but it's certainly not the only way that people can respond to having been through some pretty tough and traumatic experiences. And there's actually going to be a minority of these veterans of recent wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, who are ever going to meet the formal criteria for that condition. It doesn't mean that there are not many, many vets out there who would benefit from a chance to talk to somebody, including other veterans, including mental health professionals, about struggles that they're having with sleep, with relaxing, with debriefing and decompressing, with intrusive memories and dreams of the events that they've been through, and especially with hypervigilance, with just not being able to relax and feel comfortable in settings. So I think that to the degree that veterans know that there's resources for this, whether that be through peer support, through agencies like the Veterans Administration and any number of nonprofits and non-VA organizations, then I think, yeah, they're more likely than previous generations of veterans to reach out for those things.
Doug, let me throw that to you. Whether we're talking about PTSD or the other things John was just talking about, are we in current generations in our latest wars more vigilant about these issues than, say, the Vietnam War generation?
I would agree with that, Rob. And I think part of that is due to the experience that Vietnam veterans had to endure. If you look at some of the other activities that are happening, places like Dry Hooch, but there's one in Madison, there's a couple in Milwaukee, they are springing up in other places. Those were led by Vietnam veterans who, frankly, were shocked and disappointed with the reception that they received when they came home. And so I think that's an indication that, yes, indeed, things have changed, and I think for the better. But that said, and even though we've been more supportive of the troops in these two wars, at least lip service-wise, that doesn't change the horrific experience that these men and women have endured and how difficult it can be for them to readjust to civilian life.
And Doug, I'm glad you brought up Dry Hooch. They're one of the sponsors of the summit this week. We've talked a little bit about them on the show, though. But can you talk a little bit about what they're doing as they move into new cities?
Well, one of the things they're doing, what I love, is that they are they're open to new ideas. They're not sort of judgmental about anybody who wants to help. They've had some partnerships with the VA. They've hosted the Deadly Writers Patrol there once a month for people to come in, stop by, listen to what we're doing and share their stories. And I think it's this atmosphere and environment that is about perhaps coffee and not other stimulants. You know, a lot of vets get together at VFWs and Legions, and there might be alcohol involved. This is sort of a drug-free, a safe place. You can talk, meet with other vets. There's rap groups. There's counseling going on. I just think the kind of effort they're putting forward is really critical to young veterans coming home today.
That's the dry part of the name. And, John, I wanted to ask you about that. Veterans dealing with substance abuse problems, how widespread is that? And is there acknowledgement that it is a widespread problem?
Absolutely, Rob. Substance abuse has actually been referred to as the, quote, looming crisis on the horizon for this new generation of vets from Iraq and Afghanistan. In the setting where I work, about 80% of the veterans who I see who are seeking mental health treatment also have a current or a recent problem with substance abuse that's significant enough to get in the way of treatment, hypothetically. So it's absolutely endemic, unfortunately.
We're talking to clinical psychologist Dr. John Munt and Vietnam veteran and author Doug Bradley. They are both speaking at a Warrior Summit in Wisconsin this week that deals with veterans' issues.
And we'd love to hear from you on this. If you're a veteran or a family member of a veteran, what kind of issues were hard for you to talk about, and how did you deal with those issues? Did you find a creative outlet to express yourself that worked? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
We continue our conversation now with John Munt and Doug Bradley. They're both speaking at this week's Wisconsin Warrior Summit, Wednesday and Thursday. We're talking about the issues veterans face in returning to civilian society and the difficulty they may have in expressing what they're dealing with.
And we are taking your phone calls now. You can join in if you're a veteran. What was the hardest thing about returning to civilian life and the hardest thing to talk about? And what outlets did you find to work through these issues? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go to the phones now. We have Ralph with us in Little Suamico. Ralph, hi. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. You know, I just was calling because each Veterans Day I hear a lot of stories, and you know, some of them are inspiring, and they, you know, they show difficulties that veterans have when they come back to the States, and some of the problems they have with PTS and so forth. But you never hear stories about people that went in and they were kind of messed up when they went in and they came out better people, better employees. And I think if we had more of those, we would have not have the perceived idea among employers that if they hire a veteran that they're not going to get, they may end up with a difficult employee.
Ralph, thank you so much for bringing up that point. And I've read that elsewhere, including from some veterans, like, yes, we have problems, but by this focus on these problems, there's this stigma that surrounds us. John, what do you think of that?
I think it's a pretty important point that Ralph is bringing up. And I think about that sometimes, that in my particular role as a clinical psychologist, very frequently that means the folks I'm seeing are the folks that have come out feeling like the experience of war or deployment affected them in the negative. But I have to tell you, I know a lot of veterans outside of my clinical work, including a cousin who served 27 years, and it was absolutely what saved his life. Is going into the service, having the experiences he did, having the responsibility that he did, and swears to this day, despite multiple tours overseas in places like Iraq and Kosovo, that he is so much the better for it. I agree with Ralph that if those are the kind of stories that got anywhere near as much news as the stories of people doing violent things or taking their lives, we might have a different image of what it means to be a veteran. I do think, though, that these events, such as this Wisconsin Warrior Summit, can go a long way to getting the range of experiences that veterans have out there in front of the public. It's why a true community event like this, I think, is so important, where you have veterans and their families coming, as well as people who would like to help them, who would like to offer services to them.
Well, Doug, it seems like both of these things are true. Victims in a way, but a defining experience in life, not just for different people, but within the same person.
Yeah, I would agree too. And I think what seems to be separating the civilian and the soldier and veteran anymore is the fact that there's no shared sacrifice involved with this. Just because, you know, soldiers have sort of volunteered to serve their country in war, they didn't volunteer to take over the entire moral burden that comes with it. And you know, I think the caller made a good point, but the fact that a lot of our employers now have no connection or relationship to military experience, might not have anyone who's served in either the, you know, 1%, 2% of the population that's fought these last two wars. So I think part of it is how we've distanced ourselves from one another. And anything that we can use to bridge that gap, if it's job fairs, if it's positive stories, if it's a different take with the media, I'm all for it. But I think the reality is that we do need to help whoever, as many of these men as women, get back home. And sometimes it's the problems we have to deal with first, the challenges they're facing.
Ralph, thanks for calling and bringing that up. We'll go to Steele in Appleton now. Steele, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, everybody. Yeah, one of the guests said how Vietnam vets had set up some of these meetings and all because they weren't welcome back very much at all. And my father served Vietnam 67 and 72, ended up MIA, and then a few years later he was KIA. And a couple years after he ended up missing, my mother told me how she would get calls in the middle of the night and people just screaming at her, telling her what a worthless person she is. And families aren't spoken of as veterans. And as I was a child, I never went to a school for more than 2 years at one time. I mean, it was, you know, nice trip, but anyway, I think families are left out quite a bit.
Gotcha. Steele, a lot there. First of all, the idea of a stigma of veterans taking the blame for people who have political objections to the war they're deployed in, Doug.
Well, yeah, I mean, all you have to do is say Vietnam, and you've got that. And it's still happening today. But I think, Steele, I'm sorry for your loss. I do believe that that's one of the challenges we continue to have. And even though I think the rhetoric has been different with these last two wars, I still think there are many things that separate us rather than unite us. And that's what we need to be working on.
And, John, I wanted to throw the families part of that to you, issues that families might face when a veteran returns or, in Steele's case, doesn't return.
Well, it depends on the family, of course. If we're talking about families, as I think Steele was alluding to, who are serving through or living through multiple deployments overseas or multiple moves, you're talking about something very different than a family who has a loved one go away for a couple of months on a National Guard deployment, for example, and then return. But I think the issues can be very much the same because the family also goes through the deployment. They experience a different range of stressors, but that includes worrying about the service member. That can include all kinds of different financial stressors and headaches and family changes. But I think also what's important to remember is that the family goes through the homecoming. And homecoming is really a crucial psychological process for all involved. It's not just the event when that plane touches down and the folks come out and reunite with the families. It has to do with everybody's expectations and assumptions and fantasies for how life is going to proceed from there. And very often, life turns out to proceed pretty differently than anybody was preparing for. And that's where we start to see those folks needing some help sometimes, some counseling, some external support.
Returning to the point of creativity as an outlet for returning veterans, I mentioned earlier, Doug, you brought this journal of people's writings, poetry, memoir, fiction. Can you read one of the poems for us?
Sure. This is one of the poems we included in the last issue of the Deadly Writers Patrol magazine. It's by a really extraordinary Iraq vet named Maurice DeCal, who's from Brooklyn and has worked with two gentlemen named V.J. Iyer and Mike Ladd, and has put together, it's a project called the Veterans Dreams Project, and now they've put a lot of this spoken word, and they have an album out. Terrific stuff. This one poem I'm going to read is called Raid. I led an assault against the house of a Ba'ath party man and his family. His children were home when I kicked their door down in search of his weapons, maybe in his sock drawer, under his bed, or in his wife's armoire. Nothing. Found nothing. Broke protocol, bringing his wife outside and speaking to her, and she, fearing for his life, gave up everything. And I took him, left her and her children.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that story. We just have a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to focus, you guys both touched on this earlier, the importance of social network for returning veterans. John, why don't we start with you? Talk about the importance of finding someone, whoever it is, to talk about these things.
I just think it's crucial. It could be that somebody finds that in a family member or a good friend who's interested, who has signaled their willingness to listen when the veteran or the service member shows that they're ready for that. Can also be through counselors and mental health staff. And I get asked a lot whether a counselor or therapist has to be prior military themselves. And I don't believe that's the case, as long as they have a willingness to really hear the stories
an open mind and some cultural literacy, if you will, when it comes to veterans' issues. But I really truly believe also that aside from talking to civilians and mental health professionals, it's crucial that vets find their place in what I would call the community of veterans. And they can do that through peer support groups and programs like Dry Hooch. They can also do that through therapy groups and programs in places like the VA and veteran service organizations. Although I'll echo, as Doug alluded to, that we want to make sure that those kind of get-togethers don't necessarily just revolve around alcohol. I think that's one of the really creative things you're seeing in this country, around the country today, is just the number of organizations that are springing up that are trying to get veterans in touch with other veterans.
All right. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks again for having me and your attention to these issues.
And Doug, thank you as well for coming up.
Pleasure.
That was clinical psychologist John Munt and Doug Bradley, Vietnam vet, author of Deros Vietnam. They're both appearing at this week's Wisconsin Warrior Summit. We've got event info on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, many Wisconsin inmates rely on mental health medications but have a hard time getting them when they're released. We'll find out why coming up after the news. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
A report out yesterday from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism describes the lack of treatment and medication provided for inmates, ex-inmates, after being released from prison.
With a large number of inmates dealing with mental illness, the difficulty finding proper care can land some of them back in jail or prison. Here with us to talk about the report is Nora Hurdle. She's a reporter at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Nora, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So how common is mental illness among these inmates that we're talking about?
Some of the most recent statistics, well, this in my story, I have a statistic in there stating that about a quarter of the prisoners in the Wisconsin system are taking psychiatric medication.
So what happens when they're released? They're getting this medication, I gather, while they're incarcerated. What happens when they leave?
It depends on whether they're leaving a county jail or the state prison. When you leave the state prison, you get 2 weeks of your psychiatric medication and then a month prescription that you can fill in the community. If you're leaving jail, a lot of times you get a lot less than that. Some jails give as little as 3 days of medication.
So is it after that period just a simple thing to go out and get those prescriptions renewed, or is that when that prescription runs out, that's when we start to see issues?
It's not really a simple thing to get renewed. When someone is in a prison or jail, a lot of times if they were on Medicaid, they would get kicked off that while they're incarcerated, and then when they're released, they have to get signed back up with insurance. A lot of times they leave without or they're in prison and they leave and they don't have a doctor in the community. If they don't have a family member to help them get connected with county health services or get back connected with their doctor, that makes it really hard for them to keep on track of their medical needs.
And they've got a lot of competing needs to deal with often. I think you put out in your piece, housing and food might be the first things on their radar, and trying to track down a source to renew that prescription might not be up there.
Right. Some of the advocates that I talk to really think it's important to address all of the life areas that someone has, you know, your community, your shelter, your job. And a lot of times mental health care is just not a top priority.
So those 6 weeks run out, I guess, 2 weeks of prescription, 4 weeks of medication, of prescription then at best, then what? They're out of their medicine.
Right. A lot of these, this population ends up going to the county for health care. The counties have an obligation when people have a certain medical needs, they have to meet them. But a lot of the counties in the state have wait lists. Some of them extend several months. Some of them extend several weeks.
And so I guess the big question here is, going untreated, not getting these medications, is that leading people ultimately back into prison?
In some cases, I think definitely that's the case. You know, a lot of people who end up in the prison system, before that, they didn't know that they had a mental illness. So they go in and they get diagnosed and they start getting treatment there. But, you know, they had a mental disorder before they got in, and maybe they were treating it with alcohol or street drugs. And when they get back out again, they don't have the network to get proper health care. So they might go back to drinking and using drugs and other criminal activities to balance what is imbalanced in their own bodies.
And that's one of the more alarming things I saw in your piece, that for some of the people we're talking about, street drugs, illegal street drugs, are more accessible and more affordable than the prescriptions that they had when they came out of prison.
Yeah, mental health drugs, pharmaceuticals are, it's a big business. Those are expensive medications in a lot of cases. And a few of the people that I talked to for this story who have been in this situation, who were incarcerated or are incarcerated and have mental health problems, they have a hard time paying for their medications.
And you did talk to a couple of people in this situation, as you mentioned. What kind of stories did you hear from them?
I talked to one man who is currently incarcerated. He is in prison now. I talked to him when he was in jail. He has been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. He's 51. He's got agoraphobia and depression. He was being treated in the community, and he lost his Medicaid coverage and started drinking again, and that led him down this road of crime, and that's how he ended up back in prison. And he's afraid that when he gets out, he's not going to have the community health care that he needs to stay out of trouble.
So are there, outside of the state, are there groups around Wisconsin trying to help this transition, help ease the transition from getting medication in prison to finding it in the outside world?
Yeah, there's a lot of advocacy groups. I talked with a few of them. There's the Demeter Foundation in Madison that helps female offenders. There's this group called Infallible Helping Hands in Milwaukee that does the same thing for female offenders. Madison Area Urban Ministry. There's groups in the Fox Valley. There are also state and federal efforts to address this problem. There's an annual $10 million allocation to reduce recidivism, and some of that money goes towards inmates that have mental illness and easing that transition. So Greenlight County, for example, has a grant from that fund, the Becky Young Fund, and there's a lot of communication between the county jail and the county health and human services, and they're trying to get people having a seamless of a transition between the jail and the community.
I don't know if you looked into this, but is Wisconsin alone here, or are other states contending with some of the same issues?
I talked to the mental health director of the DOC, and he said that this is an issue that every state has. You know, how much medication do you give someone when they're about to release? And you know, you really have to rely on the counties to pick up the slack once they're out of the system.
Is there any movement at the state level to try to tackle some of these problems, make psychiatric help, make prescribers more available to inmates, ex-inmates?
Well, the Robin Voss, the Speaker of the House, he had a task force to address some mental health issues across the state, and they have recommended that state grants be given to encourage psychiatrists to move to underserved areas of the state. And that is something that might help this particular population. So it's on the radar. There was a report in 2009 that said there needed to be more mental health programs to reduce recidivism, because when someone has a mental health issue and they're not being treated, they just, it's a revolving door in and out of the prison or jail system.
Anything else that you heard from the state apart from, you know, from the Department of Corrections head, apart from that other states are dealing with this issue?
Well, I mean, I heard the same thing from the Department of Health or from our DHS that, you know, a lot of it falls on the counties and the state is doing what they can. But I heard from the counties that budgets are tight and demand is high. So even though the state and, you know, some federal dollars are going into this, there's a lot of demand.
All right, Nora, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Nora Hurdle, reporter at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Her article out yesterday is called Mentally Ill Ex-Inmates Lack Treatment and Meds.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett.
Our next guest is on a mission to get you to become more skeptical about the world around you. From dubious commercial claims to hoax stories and everything in between, he says questioning everything is in our best interest.
And he brands skepticism as a constructive and optimistic attitude, a way of life that anyone can and should, he says, embrace.
Joining us now is Guy Harrison. He's a journalist and the author of Think, Why You Should Question Everything. Guy, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, you say that skepticism could change humankind for the better overnight. How so?
Absolutely. Believe it or not, the great crisis of our world is weak skepticism, and nobody knows about it. Nobody talks about it. Parents don't teach their kids to be good skeptics. Most teachers don't teach it. Politicians never talk about it. But the truth is, we've got this huge daily disaster of weak skepticism. What I mean by that is that people tend to accept before they analyze. They believe before they think. In short, they don't think like good scientists. And that's bad for the individual. It sets them up to be a victim of scam, con artists, all these kind of things, and also to waste time, money, energy on things that probably just aren't true. And in the bigger picture, it slows all human progress. So we all have a stake in this.
Well, and you do make the case in your book that what we should do is learn to think like a scientist every day, and in short, learn to be skeptical every day, to have that part of our thinking honed. It does sound like it could take some work, being kind of on guard with our skepticism every day. What do we get out of it?
Yeah, well, you get a lot out of it. You get a safer existence, for one thing. But you also, I think, if you embrace reality and if you commit yourself to questioning everything, because you just kind of adopt, if you adopt a worldview that says, you know, I'm going to take reality as it is, and if you have a personal attitude that says, I'm not going down without a fight. When something comes up to me, some claim or belief, I'm going to make it earn its keep inside my head before I let it in. And I think when you do that, you set yourself up to have a better life. You have more time to get to the good stuff in life, the real stuff, like friends, family, love, creative work, that kind of stuff.
So that paints a pretty rosy picture of skepticism. So does that mean, you know, if you're the resident skeptic, you're at a party and someone's telling you a great story about being abducted by aliens, I mean, are you going to be the buzzkill who says, I don't think so? I mean, is it possible to be a joyful skeptic?
Absolutely. I hope I am one. And one, I cover that actually in the book. And I say, you know, a skeptic, many people perceive skeptics as just what you said, these buzzkills, these people who just want to rain on everybody's parade and take something away from them. But not at all. Skepticism, if done correctly, is constructive and optimistic. And if somebody at a party says, you know, they bring up the Roswell UFO crash or something like that, I say, wow, you know, that is a great story. I love that story. I know all about it. But did you know this story? And then I'll tell them about the real secret government conspiracy and cover-up that went on at Roswell about these spy balloons that were trying to listen to the Soviet Union testing nuclear bombs and how that was covered up and the government lied. You know, there is a cool story there, but it doesn't really involve aliens. And that's true of almost everything you come across. Somebody tells me a ghost story. Well, I can tell them some great stories about how the human brain actually works and how we all see, how we actually see how human vision works and how easy it is for us to be misled by everyday images around us and how it has nothing to do with being crazy or being silly or, you know, your education or anything like that. It's simply part of being human. And people tend to find that interesting. And when you approach people who believe stuff that's probably not true, if you do it as a friend, somebody who's offering a handout to help rather than somebody trying to just win a debate or feel superior, people tend to appreciate it.
Well, and one thing that tends to persuade us is money, is not being skeptical. Someone who goes through life believing a lot of things, maybe putting down money for things, does it come with a pretty big price tag at the end of the day, do you think?
Oh, huge, huge price tag. I've seen it. Big scale, small scale. I say I've been in stadiums, football stadiums filled with people, thousands of people who were mesmerized by a faith healer up on the stage who was going through his whole routine, and then his little army of, you know, minions or whatever fanned out with these buckets, not plates, but buckets, huge buckets, garbage cans, really, like big plastic garbage cans, and the people, most of them probably lower income people, filled these containers with cash. And then they had other people running around with credit card scanners for those who had credit cards. And I've seen it firsthand how people who are not aware of how our brains so easily deceive us and how we can be manipulated by people who portray things in certain light. If you're not a good skeptic, you can so easily be a sucker. And that bothers me. I don't like to see that. And then in the big picture, you know, look, here we are in economically challenging times, right? But the world is still squandering trillions of dollars on things like astrology, which really have no basis in science or reality. Medical quackery just drains billions of dollars every year, just in America. Worldwide, it's even more of a problem. So, yes, there's a huge price tag that comes with weak skepticism.
Okay, so let's say that this sounds pretty good. We want to bring more skepticism into our thinking life. How hard is it? What are some steps we can take?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's not as hard as you might think. You don't have to put on a lab coat. You don't have to wear safety goggles. You don't have to memorize the periodic table of elements. It's not that hard to think like a scientist in everyday life. What you have to remember is that, first of all, you don't have to always take option A or option B. Most people have this misconception in their mind. They think that if somebody comes and says, hey, there's a ghost over there, you have to either say, yes, that is a ghost, or no, I absolutely know that is not a ghost. Well, no, that's not how scientists work. A lot of times, not knowing is the right answer. Saying, I don't know, I'm ignorant of this situation, I can't give you an answer right now. That's perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with that. Good scientists admit their ignorance all the time. They have to if they're good scientists. So don't ever feel pressured to decide one way or the other when somebody comes at you with an extraordinary claim. But a couple of quick tips is always ask for evidence. Always ask somebody, how do you know this? Simply ask questions. If you ask 5 or 6 good questions, a lot of times these claims just wither and die right in front of your eyes. It's amazing to watch it happen. Just ask questions. And most important, always remember to think before you believe. Think. Do a little bit of work before you come to the conclusion. That's all you have to do. Unfortunately, most people in the world believe before they think.
Do you think you're working against human nature at all with this? Is it in human nature to be kind of a sucker, to want to believe things, to get carried away by stories and things that seem fantastical? Or would you make the argument that we are actually rational creatures, we just have to figure out how to live that more fully?
That's a great question. Yeah, I cover that in depth in the book. The answer is yes and yes. We are both. We are suckers for great stories. We're storytelling machines. Our brains cannot resist a great story, and that's a huge problem with irrational belief. But more importantly, our brains do a great job at navigating through daily life. They do really well for us. They keep us alive. If they hadn't done a good job, we wouldn't be here today. But the way they go about doing the job is not the way that we instinctively imagine that they would go about it. The way we remember things, the way we hear, the way we see, the way we analyze things and come to conclusions about things. We think we're so rational and we're so sensible about it, when actually our brain is playing all sorts of tricks on us, and you need to be aware of that. That's just part of being human, but you got to be aware of it. You got to understand. You got to know. I've got to be a good skeptic. I got to think scientifically. Otherwise, I'm going to constantly make mistakes. Now, as far as are we naturally irrational believing creatures, yes, we are, but we're also naturally rational scientists. That's part of us, too. I used to be a science teacher, and I saw little kids instinctively explore, question, analyze, doubt. I've seen all that. It's in us, too. We've got both. It's just a matter of, you know, and they all have their place, but you've got to ask yourself, okay, what do I want to do? Do I want to go really heavily on this emotional side? Not emotional, I don't want to give emotions a bad name, but do I want to go heavily on this side that just goes with gut feelings and hunches and trusts and the last thing I heard? Or do I want to be a really good thinker, one who is careful about what I make, what conclusions I draw?
Now, you also talk a lot about taking care of our brains. Now, this is our skeptical organ that we have to have in good fighting shape. So then, other than eating well and doing crossword puzzles or Sudoku, what can we do to make sure that our brains stay sharp?
Yeah, that it's really important. You know, I've got a whole chapter on that you've got to take care of your brain. And we don't think about it enough because our brains are hidden away inside our skulls, so we don't really see it. But you know, I give an example. People will say, oh, I better not eat any more ice cream. You know, it goes straight to my butt or straight to my thighs or something like that. But you never hear anybody say, whoa, I better ease off on the ice cream here because it just goes straight to my brain and makes me grow a sloppy thinker. But that's the reality. A poor diet, eating bad food makes you a bad thinker. And people need to learn this. And it's very simple. You don't have to have magic potions or take miracle drugs or anything like that. It's, you know, good basic nutrition, leafy green vegetables, blueberries, stuff like that. Lots of water, lots of sleep. You need to rest. And a big thing that's very important is physical activity. Our brains evolved to be perched atop a mobile platform, not a platform that lies on a couch, sits in a chair all day, sits in a car to and from, and never gets up and moves. We are, you know, for 99.9% of human existence, we have been standing and walking most of the day. We average human walk 12 miles a day, okay? This all changed like a century ago, okay? It's pretty recent that this changed. And that's the problem is our brain needs that circulation, that blood flow. It needs that to operate properly. And there's all kinds of good science that I cite in the book that shows this and hopefully will inspire people to get going.
Now, all right. That's a lot of good advice to go right there. Guy, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate all the ideas.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Guy Harrison. He's the author of Think, Why You Should Question Everything.